You mentioned aircraft, and that also, you know, in my bit of background research on the industry, you know, that did come in the mid '80s. So aircraft was already there when you you started. So did you use spotters from planes from the beginning, or I guess at first not, and that went around in Carrington Island probably.
At Carrington, we did not. It was up at Roselle, and I had a good friend, Chuck Collins, who went to Westminster College with me, and we literally would drive out to number 2 airport. We would rent a 172 for whatever the hourly charges were, and we'd get in the plane, and he'd fly up there, and he would spot egg, and then he would land at Roselle, and then he would go out in the afternoon and give us one more spot before, and then he would take off. And it was... That's how we started, and it was all daylight.
Right.
And, but those patches were so big. All he really had to do was just get us,
into
the vicinity of it. And oftentimes he would say, you know, just leave Roselle Point and go 190 for 15 miles. You know, and we didn't even have a ship's compass. We didn't even have a structure over the. We were literally driving these boats back then with a tiller. And so we were just running the patch, but then it got more and more sophisticated. We ended up hiring another good friend of mine, Andy Wallace, who he had a 1956 Super Cub with the cloth wing, the yellow plane, tail dragger, and that plane was perfect because we could land anywhere: Antelope Island, Stansbury Island, Fremont Island, Promontory. Any road, any strip, he could put it down, and that reduces obviously flight time, which reduces cost, but it also reduces stress on the pilot. And then it got to the point where it got so busy we had to hire another person who was the spotter. So you'd have one guy flying and another guy communicating with the boats.
Is this to avoid collisions?
Yes. Yeah. Because early on there weren't that many planes and people were spread out, but as it got ramped up, about 95, it was just crazy. And so the pilot had to be just focused on who was out in front or below or above, and it was just too much for the pilot to do. We actually got to the point where Clover, who controls all the F-16s out in the bombing range, got involved with stacking us. They would stack the planes as they went out by MAGCOR, and they got really close to the Clover airspace, or into Clover airspace. There was a guy on the West Desert who would just start stacking. He would just say, all right, you're at 6,000, you're at 65, you're at 7, 70, you know, and he would keep us. And it was actually a godsend, because it was much...
And this was military that was doing this.
The military was doing it to keep a bunch of brine shrimpers from crashing over. Because I can't remember exactly where the military range... You know,
well, from Lakeside West, and I know it extends over the lake a ways.
And we were fishing in this area, and they would be controlling us here and up into there. As soon as we went past... Carrington
Island to the west,
and they would stack us up, so that was nice to have that little, at least somebody was kind of watching.
Yeah.
And then I think people, some of the pilots actually had collision avoidance stuff in their airplane, TCAS I think they call it. It sends off an alarm if there's...
Did collisions occur? Were there any crashes?
I don't remember any planes. There were some close calls. I remember some pilots really mad, you know. And there was a few, I think, what they would call a rogue pilot, you know, just somebody who didn't really care what the rules were. They'd fly wherever they wanted. There was boat collisions, but most of those were on purpose. You know, it was a confrontation on the patch of egg. And I never had one. But I've heard of, you know, the guys would just get so frustrated. They're like, what are you doing? You're just in. And they would come over and just put their boat on this guy and just try to ram him out of the way. And so there was broken engines and a lot of mad people.
Yeah.